Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 65. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, Herr Professor Dr. The Reverend Squadron Leader, Marcus Hellier.
Hello, Michael. Hello to our listeners. Well, I'm just sort of finishing the catering for a very serious ceremony we're about to have here in the bunker. We're
quite sad.
Very sad event. We're having a wake for something that served its country long and well.
And was much loved.
Much loved, certainly by me. And that is, of course, the Australian National Audit Office's Major Projects Report, which was cruelly, cruelly murdered about 10 days ago.
It was a silent crime.
Yes, it was done on a Friday. Of course, the time when events like this are buried from media scrutiny. Anyway, we'll talk about this in a lot more detail later on. I think it is seriously actually a very serious and quite depressing event. It deserves a lot of coverage.
It does.
And where are you, Michael?
Well, Marcus, if it's a bit scratchy, I'm calling in remotely.
Okay.
I'm in, I can't say which Canberra suburb at the moment. I'm dividing half my time siphoning petrol and the other half just liberating some solar panels that I can see aren't really being used as efficiently as their owners might use them to set the bunker up. And the reason I'm doing that, frankly, is you have let yourself down.
I knew it was going to get
you've
to this.
You've let Strategic Analysis Australia down, and you've let the bunker down. The Hellier-Fisher-Tropf process was based on a lie.
Look, it's not my fault, Michael. Look, the goal was to synthesize raw material such as defense strategic reviews, various defense reports, and put them to good use, turning them into liquid fuel. But you can't bend the laws of physics, Michael. There are some things that are just ultimately good for nothing.
I know what you're going to say.
They are not. There is no conceivable good use for them.
You know, I know.
I can't turn defense strategic reports into something useful. So, yes,
that's
why we've sent you out to find solar panels.
You're telling me it's alchemy. You're telling me it's laws of physics. This is a simple biological problem. Your process to turn government documentation, defense and other reports, so readily available into liquid fuel relied on bacteria being able to live in their presence. You're going to blame me because I fed the National Anti-Corruption Commission's report, Operation Myrtleford.
Yeah, I thought that went into the hopper. I'm going, more feedstock. Good thing.
445 pages of what I thought was prime feedstock for your process.
Turned out to be yet another contaminant.
Totally toxic. A totally toxic document that killed the bacteria. And I'm left cleaning up your mess.
Well, anyway, we'll talk about that document in more detail later on. So, look, we did take the advice of many right-wing commentators, people on social media who keep telling Australia to put their, quote, big boy pants on and build nuclear power plants. So we have been trying to build a nuclear power plant to build the bunker. The problem is it will take another 20 years to get there.
Well, and some of that enriched stuff that we've been storing may not have helped the bacteria in the Tropf process.
So that's why we've sent you out to steal some solar panels.
Yeah. Well, look, back to this Major Projects report. I think it's fantastic you got White Lady Funerals in for the event. But why? Why are you grief-stricken with this loss of this report?
Well, I am very grief-stricken by this because the ANAO Major Projects report, published every year, essentially looks at roughly 20 to 25 of defence's biggest capability acquisition projects. And the team that does it from the ANAO has access to Defence's project management data. So they can draw on
Defence's internal information about how the projects are going.
Correct. Right. Correct. So this is, you know, direct insight into how those projects are going.
And from an independent bunch of intelligent people.
Correct.
Looking to assess the performance.
Correct. And which projects they looked at was essentially determined by the Joint Committee of Public Accounts and Audit. So a parliamentary committee made up of members of parliament from the lower house, senators from the upper house. So it was done essentially, it was commissioned by the JCP.
It was the power of that parliamentary committee that enabled ANAO to do that work.
Correct.
But it's that committee, the JCPAA, that committed the murder.
Correct. So the JCPAA on a quiet Friday afternoon put out an announcement basically saying that it's all over. So for 18 years, this document has been produced, and I will say that it is really the only source of detailed, reliable information on what is going on inside Defence's capital acquisition program.
About the classic triangle, cost, schedule and performance, about these multi-billion dollar projects.
Correct. Now, it didn't cover the whole thing. It covered sort of between a third and a half of it by value, but certainly better than nothing. I mean, the only other source of information around Defence's major projects is the top 30 acquisition projects table in the annual budget. And there you have essentially one paragraph on them.
One table, one paragraph.
One paragraph per project. Literally, you know, for things like Joint Strike Fighter or DEF-1, the nuclear submarine project. One paragraph. So we actually got real information. And it, yes, it referred to the Iron Triangle, as you say, but there was also just basic contextual information that we don't see anymore, like the number of a project, you know, Land 1234, the name of a project.
What it was beyond the
when
number.
It was approved, what it was actually approved to acquire.
Well, and this last one that had almost been completely strangled with that silken cord that Defence has been tying around the audit office access to information, it still had a few chunks of real insight. Like it had about the Hunter program, that they were at the edge of engineering potential, trying to juggle issues like its top weight and its growth margins. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I might put a picture of the latest rendering of the Hunter that's been put on UK Navy Lookout to show what that means. That by being at the margins,
it's looking a little top heavy, I have to say.
If it was a child, it would have childhood obesity. It's very
that's
fat.
That's a bit cruel.
And I do not mean PHAT. I mean FAT. It is obese at the start of its life. And as with a human, a ship that starts obese is going to have a difficult, troubled life.
So why has this occurred? Why has the...
Why have they killed it?
Why has the major projects report been sent to swim with the fishes? Well, roughly 3 years ago, a strange thing started.
I love it when you tell me a story. Yep.
3 years ago, Defence decided that it wasn't actually going to disclose all of the information that it had been disclosing for the previous 15 years.
Routinely disclosed.
Yes, and the justification provided for this, well, you know, if we provide all of this information, it's a national security threat because the bad guys can put all of this together and, you know, it could harm our security. So some of the information that wasn't being disclosed included schedule information. So previously, the major projects report included the FOC date, the final operating capability date for these projects. So when the entire capability was in service and you could actually
when the military would have something,
So Defence then said, well, we can't disclose these dates. They're classified now. Now, why something that had been released for 15 years suddenly became classified was justified with what I think is a kind of very lazy throwaway line that, well, it's national security.
Yep.
We're in a very dangerous security space. Yep. We can't make this stuff available anymore.
You know, one thing that is dangerous, because I remember Dickie Miles, not Richard, but Dickie Miles, the defence minister, early in his tenure as defence minister, well, he was mainly the deputy prime minister, but he did, when he was doing some of the defence
stuff. I think it was Thursdays is when he was defence minister.
Yeah, he put out a press release. It was something like, might get this figure wrong, but 97 years of delay and hundreds of billions of dollars over budget. Defence's major projects are in a whole lot of trouble and it's all the fault of the previous government and he's going to fix it. See, people like Dickie could use the kind of information in this report to outrageously slander the Defence Department for chronically delayed delivery of major capability. That's got to stop.
Yes, indeed. I mean, so because the major projects report was public, It therefore, by definition, went to the last people in the world that the government wants this information going to, which is the opposition. So oppositions have made good use of the Major Projects Report to say, look, you're years and years late, you're gazillions over budget, terrible. Yeah. And yes, so it does get politicised in this way, but it actually does provide the analytical community, the people who are actually trying to understand the risks around these projects and understand what is being delivered when, to actually understand, are we getting what the Australian people need?
And what we're paying for.
So it was the only place you could get this information.
And look, I mean, let's just remind people, bad performance doesn't improve when you're able to hide it.
No.
And there has been bad performance in delivery of capability by defence for a long time. In fact, not many Australians pay much attention to the Byzantine workings of Australia's defence organisation because they haven't had to when we lived in quieter times. But one thing you'll often hear from people is, they're just not good at spending taxpayer money and their projects always seem to be troubled. So there's a real interest there from the organisation and the senior leadership in not having people understand how well they're doing. But that is a direct opposite interest that the taxpayers and the parliament should have, because transparency drives better performance.
Yeah, so defence has been slowly choking down the amount of information it's provided. So the ANAO can no longer make any kind of assessment on whether individual projects or the portfolio as a whole is being delivered on schedule. So what has the JCPAA done in response to this?
Well, they've got to be mad as hell with defence, and they've got to be realising that this is a moment where the parliament and the legislative arm of government needs to assert its independent power over the executive and compel defence, the minister and the officials, to provide the information that the audit office needs.
Let me just interrupt you. No, that is not what the committee has done.
Oh.
In fact, one might describe the committee as simply rolling over. So they've pretty much rolled over and said, well, okay, since we can't get the information out of defence on a couple of crucial areas, we're just not going to do that at all anymore. So not only are we not getting things like schedule information, we're not getting any information whatsoever.
So we will not now get further advice about whether the Hunter has solved its childhood obesity problem?
I don't believe so. Ooh. So it's kind of interesting because the chair of the JCPAA is a man called Josh Burns. And Josh Burns is a Labor MP, comes from the Victorian right faction of the Labor Party. Now, one might go, well, okay, how is this relevant? Well, who is the head of the Victorian right faction of the Labor Party?
Is it Dickey?
It is, in fact, a certain Richard Miles, the Deputy Prime Minister.
Probably Richard in that role.
And Minister for Defence, i.e. the person who stands at most to lose in terms of reputation should defence underdeliver. Now, Richard Miles also, by virtue of the fact that he is the head of this faction, he is able to end ministers' careers. In fact, we saw after the last election, two serving ministers lost their portfolios because Mr. Miles needed to reward a couple of members of his faction. Now, call me cynical.
You are very cynical, Miles.
But Josh Burns might be thinking, if I ever want to rise from the backbench to the front bench, I got to keep Richard Miles happy.
The numbers man. He keeps the numbers man happy by making sure that no numbers about defence performance are ever disclosed.
That Richard Miles doesn't get embarrassed by bad disclosures in the Major Projects Report.
That's possible, and I'm sure they're both ethically upstanding individuals serving our country manfully and to the best of their ability.
Personfully, thank you.
But I think the other thing it reveals is even what's meant to be a powerful parliamentary committee doesn't like to cause discomfort to the Mandarin class and people like the Secretary and Chief of Defence Force. And because, frankly, both those senior officials would love this embuggerance of the ANAO report to go away, because it only makes them have to explain their poor performance every year, and they hate it.
Well, so, yes, what's going to happen now? Well, according to Mr. Burns, this glaring gap in transparency will be filled in two ways. The first is that the committee now apparently will focus more rigorously and closely on the ANAO's other reports, performance reports.
And you'll have more time to focus on the reports the ANAO is able to do.
Yes.
Not the key one that was the most important one that they ever did.
Yes. So this report that covers 20 to 25 projects is going away. So they're going to focus more closely on the performance reports.
Ooh.
Now, the ANAO, on average, does 5 or 6 performance reports on the aspects of the defence portfolio.
Ooh.
Of them, one, on average, is a major capability project. So somehow, by focusing on that one individual project, they're going to understand
the vibe.
The vibe, I guess, of how the overall portfolio is going. Let me just remind you, that overall portfolio is worth about $200 billion.
Okay? Yeah,
so but by pulling out one little project, they're going to understand somehow how that entire portfolio is being delivered.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, this is the butterfly effect. If you can understand the butterfly flapping its wing in South America, you will understand why an earthquake happened in Outer Mongolia. So they're applying that principle from the natural world. The other thing that strikes me is if Defence is refusing to give key information to the audit office around 25 projects, why is it going to hand over even more key detailed information about even one?
That is a good question.
Mm.
Now, the second thing, measure, that will ensure transparency will continue, according to Mr. Josh Burns, the chair of the JCPAA,
member of Bright Future,
member of the Victorian Right faction of the Labor Party,
is
that we now have this new committee that was brought into existence through legislation, the Joint Standing Committee on Defence, modelled after the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence.
Parliamentary Joint Committee on Defence, very exciting.
Yes. Who will be on this committee?
Would it be the parties of government?
Yes, the parties of government, i.e. the
One Nation.
Labor Party. Not One
Not
Nation.
Not One Nation.
Not One Nation. No. Those nasty Greens will not be on.
Look, you can't have woke lefty types who don't agree with everything that you're doing asking pesky questions. And, I mean, One Nation should be out too, because their main shtick is hate and putting hate on you about what you're doing, because you're the big end of town. So both those groups shouldn't be on this committee. So, quite right, sir.
So, and the Joint Stand Committee on Defence, well, it's going to have these the ability to look at classified material. Ooh. So that means it has to meet out
in
of public
secret.
View,
it,
in secret,
none of this
behind
can
closed
be public.
Doors.
None of this can be public.
It's only going to have members of the Labor Party and the Coalition, i.e. the two parties who are responsible for decisions such as AUKUS, decisions such as the Type 26 Hunter program. So all of the really
budget.
Stinky, risky things, they're responsible for. So they have minimal interest in saying, gosh, these are really bad.
Well, they're all complicit in the things that they're examining.
Yes.
They have no interest in disturbing the direction of travel of defence. And my experience is they pay almost obsequious deference to senior military people and even to the most senior civilian people in defence. So they might, you know, when they're chatting back in their electorates, make snide remarks about the incompetence of defence. But when they're dealing with the hierarchy, it is disturbing the unctuous obsequiousness you see on display.
Plus, the backbenchers who make up the committee members have virtually nothing in the way of resourcing that would actually allow them to prepare for these meetings and ask insightful, probing questions. In fact, one of the things that backbenchers until now have used to formulate probing questions.
Let me guess, the thing we are now burying here tonight.
Would it be the major projects report? But that's now gone. So how this is going to work is that they'll have this meeting. Defence will provide them
We know that they had the meeting?
I don't know. Maybe
no,
not.
That could be
but
secret.
Defence will provide them with information, in quotation marks, before the meeting.
Yeah.
The backbenchers will look at this and go, I don't know. Yeah, that looks all right. but I have no way to question this. And, oh, the major projects report is gone, so I don't really have any data. You tell me everything's going swimmingly well on the Hunter-class frigate or AUKUS or any other project.
I don't want to sound stupid. There's a lot of jargon here I don't understand.
So that sounds pretty good. And then Mr. Burns can now tick the transparency and accountability box. All done.
So the transparency will happen in secret. The public can't know anything about it, but we're all going to be assured it's fine. You know how I think this is going to affect other parliamentary processes like Senate estimates? I can imagine a senator saying, so I remember seeing in the last of the ill-fated major project reports that the Hunter frigate was at the margins of engineering.
Stop there. Sorry, we have to take this in camera. I mean, that's a capability issue, Senator. I'm sorry. I can't talk about this in this public forum of Senate estimates. We will cover that off in the Joint Standing Committee on Defence because the performance characteristics of the Hunter frigate,
yes,
very super classified, secret. I'm afraid. Very classified.
Can you assure me that you've had a really detailed discussion about these issues with that secret committee that no one can hear about?
Well, that's a classified issue. Right. But trust me, Senator, trust us.
Yes.
I mean, we are the Mandarins.
Yes.
It's all going very well.
Okay.
Now, I would extend an invitation for you to attend the next meeting of the Joint Standing Committee on Defence where we discuss the Hunter frigate and how well it's going.
Yeah.
But because you're a member of the Stinkin' Greens, I can't do that.
Well, I'm with One Nation, actually.
Oh, well, you're not as stinky, but I still can't invite you.
Okay, but you can assure me that everything's good and anything that isn't good is discussed in secret.
Well, I'm a Mandarin.
Right. Okay, well, thank you.
Of course, you have to trust
me. If I could just thank you very much for your testimony.
Well, I'm a very busy man, so if you would stop grovelling, I'll need to get back.
Okay, well, thank you. I just want to thank you again for your service.
Stop grovelling.
So that's Senate estimates gutted as well as the ANAO.
Yep.
So just as we go into far more dangerous times in the world, and as we see our defence force getting weaker despite billions of dollars being poured into it, the public and the parliament are going to know even less about how things are going than now.
Yes, which is really quite remarkable because, again, you know, we live in a goldfish kind of world, but I can still remember from about 3.5 months ago, the Albanese government announced the, quote, biggest reform of the defence organisation
for 50 years.
In 50 years.
Yeah.
And you know what had prompted this, Michael? Do you remember?
I do. I think it was the defence procurement, like the major projects, was going very badly.
Very badly.
And it needed to be fundamentally changed and reformed.
Yes.
And it was going to be done through a process of change that Minister Pat Conroy would oversee, and it would take 18 months. But it was because one of the things was the Secretary and CDF are in the way of that procurement, getting in the way of the procurement being done well. Mm. And this needed to be taken out of their hands, stuck in a separate agency. But it was because major projects weren't going well.
Yes, so major projects weren't going well, and the Australian people wanted to see that they were getting better bang for their buck. So the Australian people apparently have a right to know how well major projects are being delivered.
And they need to be better delivered than they are now.
And it needs to be better delivered, and we need to fundamentally restructure the defence organisation.
So you're saying that need for the Australian public to know that this is being done better is not going to be met by having it all happen in secret?
I don't believe so, Michael.
It does sound incongruous.
In fact, the one document that really could provide the Australian public with any insight into how well or otherwise the capability program was being delivered has just been assassinated.
Well, look, the Australian public are very busy people. Like, I wasn't the only person siphoning fuel and snaffling solar panels out here in northern Canberra today. They're very busy people. They've got a lot on their mind. Stuff like that report saying that the $59 billion is being spent badly and that the Hunter frigates have a childhood obesity problem, that is only going to upset them. And frankly, they've got enough things to worry about. So I'm right with the government in neutering that important report and hiding the state of our military and the competence of our department. I think that will only reassure the Australian public.
Well, I think if you're a Mandarin whose mantra has always been, trust me, I'm a Mandarin, you're thinking this is a very good thing.
Yes.
Because now the public has no other option but to trust you. So documents such as the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's cost of defence report that I used to do.
You did.
Under your incredible supervision, inspiring leadership. I was a very busy man, but I did
occasionally flick through what you'd done.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could have done it without
you. Senior people are very busy people.
So I used to do that, and before me, Mark Thompson did that for a long time, and ASPE has continued to do it since I've left.
In a way.
I would have to say that it is virtually impossible to do that without something like the Major Projects Report, because there is so little other information out there about defence's programs.
Well, that brings me to one other observation about this decision to kill that external objective analysis of defence performance. When John Howard was the Prime Minister back in about 2000, he was dissatisfied with the quality of advice that he got from the senior public servants and military officials, not just in defence, but certainly in defence. And he was smart enough to know, maybe if I'm not getting the best advice out of the Canberra bureaucracy, maybe I need an alternative source that isn't in the bureaucracy. So he set up something called the Australian Strategic Policy Institute with the deliberate charter principle of providing an alternative source of advice.
Correct. It had three main goals. First one was to provide an alternative source of advice, i.e. alternative to the Mandarins.
Yep.
Secondly, it was meant to develop a robust debate and understanding in the broader community about defence issues. So we actually would have informed discussion and debate around defence issues. And the third one was generating the, quote, next generation of strategic thinkers. So there was a view there from John Howard that we couldn't quarantine policy debate and policy advice just to the Mandarins.
Yep.
It needed to be a broader enterprise.
Yep.
That broader enterprise, however, can only function effectively if there is information, if there is data for it to analyze. Well, that has now gone. And so the Mandarins, I think, will be actually celebrating their final victory over this concept that there can be other inputs into policymaking than just the views of the Mandarins.
I think it's been a rolling campaign for 26 years now, and this final victory over the Parliamentary Committee and the Audit Office, that just is the last, it's the sort of glazed cherry on the top of the pig snout.
Yes, because now the Mandarins can simply say, your opinion, your criticism of the
unwarranted, unfounded,
or your criticism of the department and its under-delivery, it's not founded on any evidence whatsoever. We don't have to believe you. Why should we believe you? That's not based on any data whatsoever.
If you knew what I knew and what I briefed the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Defence,
you
wouldn't be saying what you're saying. Yes.
Now, and so this is, we now have, I think, rather than that kind of broader informed public debate, we now have what I like to, getting inspiration from President Eisenhower, who when he retired from office.
Yes, his farewell address.
His farewell address, he referred to this thing called the military-industrial complex that was, you know, driving American policy, and he warned decision makers about the military-industrial complex.
He said it was a danger to America.
Yes.
And a danger to democracy.
I think we've now entered the age here
In Australia,
of the military advisory complex. So, i.e.
What is that?
Well, that is essentially advice and policy making is now kind of centered on this very small community of senior public servants, senior military people and ministers who all sort of work together to kind of support each other. Don't rock the boat.
Yes.
Yeah, well, we don't want any viewpoints from external people, because that may suggest there are actually alternatives here to what we've decided to do.
Yes.
There may be alternatives to selling all of our gas offshore, such as there may be another way, such as gas reservation. There may be an alternative to holding vanishingly small amounts of liquid fuel onshore. And there may be alternatives to projects such as the Hunter or AUKUS.
Not AUKUS, Marcus, no.
So, but where we are now is we've got the ministers who tell secretaries and senior military people what they want.
Yep.
They then sort of give them what the ministers
implement
want.
The ministers' programs.
The ministers go, well, actually, all right, no, we've got a sort of, we need robust accountability here.
Ooh.
So to get a second opinion to that offered by the secretary, I'm going to pay the previous incumbent of the secretary's position $5,500 a day to give me a second opinion, which will, I believe, look remarkably similar to my own view and the view of the current secretary.
Who else could you get an alternative view from, apart from someone who is immersed in that system and had made all the decisions that had led to the point that you were now?
So we also part of the MAC, the Military Advisory Complex, or the Mandarin Advisory Complex.
Well, I like the Mandarin Advisory Complex. I also like to draw in, I think your point about ex-politicians is so relevant too. I mean, it is that group, isn't it, of current politicians who have an eye to their future employment, setting up advisory firms, consultancy firms, giving access to people, maybe bringing knowledge out of their time as minister. They routinely turn up on boards or as consultants or as advisors to the kind of companies and outfits that are participating in this system. Then there's the Mandarin class, and as you say, that's like the Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave. If you're a national treasure Mandarin, you get called back to do reviews, whether it's someone like Peter Varghese, called back from the university up in Brisbane to kill off the think tank world and give control to the Mandarins.
Well, no. Mr. Varghese did not kill off the think tank world.
So to do an objective analysis.
He was asked to do a review of the broader national security community, and he came to the conclusion that the role of the national security community was to essentially be a research arm
for the secretaries,
for the Mandarins, to work on problems set by the Mandarins using a stingy amount of funding doled out by the Mandarins.
And that the Mandarins would not just set their priorities, because they know the questions that the ministers might want to ask secretaries and get an alternative view on. They would also assess how well that alternative view was provided. And as we know, anything that complicates a secretary's relationship with their minister is a bad thing. So there were some strange incentives built into the Varghese model.
So we have this complex now made up of former ministers, former Mandarins, former senior people, all kind of providing access to each other for large amounts of money, or providing reports.
Yes.
Basically looking at what they previously did and marking their own homework on what they previously did.
They're often quite happy with what they previously did, and they often suggest minor tweaks that were mainly because their successors didn't quite divine the perfection of how they left it.
Yeah, they might say come up with 100 or so recommendations.
It's best to come up with a large number.
But it's sort of tweaks. So.
But if you have a large number of tweaks, it sounds very impressive.
It sounds, well, I mean, if you're charging $5,500 a day, I mean, you don't want to make six recommendations.
No, you got to.
That's not value for money.
No, you got to puff it out a bit. You got to pat it.
You need at least 100 recommendations.
Well, I think this actually is a big problem, because the problem with that military advisory complex, I mean, it's interesting you chose the word advisory instead of industrial. And I think that's because one of the primary outputs of this sort of Canberra phenomenon is words and reports and invoices.
Not actual military capability.
Actual military capability.
Yes.
Or in the case of other parts of government, actual competent delivery of services. And if what you want is continuity of whatever you are currently doing, getting this ex-Mandarin, ex-military, ex-politician class in to give you any second look at things ensures continuity. You will not rock the boat. So it works extremely well for all concerned.
Yes, but the... Well, it works very well for all concerned, except the people who are paying for this, which is the Australian taxpayer.
Yes, except for the Australian taxpayer who wants a powerful Australian military in a dangerous world, or wants something like, I don't know, social security benefits delivered fairly and legally.
Yes. Well, and I would argue it doesn't work very well for the government either. Because the government may actually, it has no options. Because essentially this military advisory complex has FAFO'd around for decades now.
Well, it's FA'd, and we are now finding out. We're at the nasty rear end of FAFO.
Yes, we have found out we don't actually have much in the way of deployable military capability. So we're sending a wedge tail to the Gulf. Why? Well, partly because we got nothing else.
Yep.
We don't have a deployable navy.
We might be able to send special forces soon if we want to help secure the coastline around Hormuz.
We're pretty thin on options because we've effed around.
Yeah, and we're now effing out. I would say,
and we're now finding out.
Why am I out having to siphon petrol tanks and unbolt solar panels? It's because I listened to the ministers and the mandarins about the fuel security issue in the last week, and they tried to tell the Australian people and public that there was no problem. We had ministers saying there's no problem with fuel. All the fuel we were meant to have, we have.
The ships are still arriving. The fact that those ships left the Middle East before the Gulf was closed is somehow escapes them.
But it's this kind of protective instinct to say that everything's fine, because somehow you don't want to upset the Australian public, or you don't want to admit that there might be a problem, because then you might be somehow accountable for the problem.
Or we might have to spend some money.
So we get these nonsense positions out of the ministers and the mandarins.
Relying on advice from agencies such as Treasury, which say you can rely on just-in-time
global
supply chains. It works fine. It's worked great since 1945. We'll just keep relying on that. All those terms like competitive advantage and blah, 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 blah. It'll work fine.
Well, and that's a case where there has been alternative advice saying this was a growing problem. The former Air Vice Marshal John Blackburn, he didn't seem to buy in to the gravy train of, you know, doing the kind of things we've been talking about. He did some independent analysis, a whole lot of public advocacy with a bunch of colleagues for over 10 years, telling us that our fuel storage arrangements and our dependence on offshore supply and refining was going to cause a crisis at some point.
Yes.
Well, we're now approaching that, but we've had a government and a bunch of officials that's tried to tell us something we all know isn't true, which is the world and Australia are not entering an energy crisis.
Well, John Blackburn is a very decent person, so I doubt he is sitting there going, I told you so, I told you so, I told you so. But if anybody has a right to do that, it is John Blackburn.
Well, I'd say he's not feeling any better for being right.
No.
He's probably feeling quite aggrieved and wondering how he could have influenced it more. But there was alternative advice on that question.
Correct. And interestingly, Mr. Barnaby Joyce, who I believe used to be Deputy Prime Minister when he was leader of the National Party.
I don't think he was quite as august as Richard Marles, Marcus. I actually take exception to you trying to equate the gravitas of the current Deputy Prime Minister with Mr. Barnaby Joyce.
Well,
so
I'm not sure the current Deputy Prime Minister has ever been found lying on his back in the street in an inner city Canberra suburb while he was talking on his mobile phone.
That's what I'm talking about. There's gravitas to Mr. Miles.
Anyway, Barnaby Joyce, to his credit, has now come out and said, essentially, we effed around. Unfortunately, we're now finding out. And I wish I hadn't effed around when I was Deputy Prime Minister.
Is this on fuel?
This is on fuel. So, quoting ABC News, Barnaby Joyce, the former Nationals leader turned One Nation MP, says he regrets not doing more to secure emergency fuel reserves when the coalition was in power.
Ooh.
Mm. So he had his shot and he
missed.
Effed around.
Well, I mean, in one way, I think that proves your point that we did not face an obvious problem at the time, and it would have taken some political courage and some money, but we'd all be better off right now. But Barnaby Joyce at least has some respect from me for admitting that he made a mistake. That's a very rare thing in public office now.
Yes, well, I'm not sure any politicians will admit to similar mistakes around selecting the Hunter frigate or signing up to AUKUS, but I don't know. Maybe, I don't know, will we find out one day?
Regrets, they had a few, but at the time too few to mention.
Anyway, so, all right, well, look, moving on. It's on to a slightly related topic.
Yeah, one of the things that would have made officials' performance in spending money and meeting and working in accordance with taxpayers' interests more likely to improve would have been if the National Anti-Corruption Commission, headed by, I'm not sure if he's a retired reservist military officer.
No, he's current.
I think he's still a
Major General Burton, yeah. I believe, is still a reservist, Major General.
Anyway, the NAC, National Anti-Corruption Commission, if they had put together a really powerful report about the robo-debt scandal and the illegality of that scheme that affected so many Australians, normally quite poor Australians, so some of the more vulnerable people in our society.
Well, they did just put out 450 pages.
No, they didn't, Marcus. It was only 445 pages. And they looked at six
which
people.
I cannot turn into liquid fuel, but anyway.
Well, it killed the process.
So you're what are you saying, Mike? You don't think this is a good report?
I do not. Partly because, A, it is 445 pages long. And I admit to the suspicion when I see a document that's 445 pages long that the authors do not want it read or comprehended. You make it so dense and so long that no one reads it. So I think the fact that it was so long was a problem in itself. And unfortunately, I've read almost all of it. I've still got some of the back end to go.
You are a braver man than I. I have looked at it.
I was 273 pages in, and I mainly just had a quick journey through the bureaucratic life inside the Department of Human Services as they cobbled together what can only be described as a half-assed, incompetent scheme to make spurious automatic calculations of benefit recipients' debts and then the onus of proof on those beneficiaries to disprove the debt or have debt recovery action taken. That was what robo-debt was. And the first 270 pages are this turgid recital of who sent what to whom on what date, and was it an email, was it a conversation, interspersed with a little bit of narrative about some of the participants, which mainly consists of, oh, I never thought about the legal aspect, or we didn't settle that advice, or should we have sent them the 2014 legal advice or just the 2017 advice, or we didn't really settle that. I can't really remember discussing anything with the minister. The secretary was very busy, very complex. Oh, and the key culprit is dead.
So just to take a little walk back in time, we had the now infamous robo-debt scandal, which was in fact based on, it was fundamentally illegal to use income averaging to determine benefit recipients' income was illegal. Though, of course, whether the participants, the architects of this system knew it was illegal is kind of one of the focuses of this report from the NAC. But we have since had, after the robo-debt scheme was ended, after a lot of misery and possibly including suicides, we had a Royal Commission. And a Royal Commission at great length looked at it. In a very forensic way. And it referred a number of people to the NAC, the Anti-Corruption Commission.
Mm-hmm. Amongst them,
for further investigation.
The relevant minister, Scott Morrison at the time, and the former secretary and deputy secretaries and other officials.
Yes, though it was not made public at the time.
No.
The identities of those people. So their identities is now public.
Ooh.
So the NAC received this handball and went, got nothing to do with us.
Ooh,
we're not going to cover this.
I don't know why you sent me this package.
Why are you sending me this? So that then prompted much outrage.
Public outrage.
Much public outrage. Thousands. The NAC received thousands of public submissions saying this was outrageous.
Would it have been better if it had been secret that the Royal Commission had sent it to them? Because there's a lot of sensitive information involved. I think if they'd taken the model of the new Defence Committee, they could have kept this all secret and the public needn't have worried. But anyway, they chose to have it as a public referral.
Anyway, the NAC's own inspector then looked into the decision to not hold an investigation and actually came out and said that the NAC's own commissioner had engaged in, quote, officer misconduct by mismanaging his conflict of interest.
Because the National Anti-Corruption Commission had engaged in misconduct.
Because apparently he knew one of the six individuals referred to the NAC quite well.
Ooh.
So the own inspector said, you guys have screwed up. So the NAC looked at it again and said, oh, maybe we should hold an investigation. So they have now held an investigation and looked at these six individuals. ranging from, yes, Scott Morrison, the former minister responsible for this, the former secretary, and three relatively senior officials. What is the outcome of this? After you've gone through the 450 pages, what is the outcome?
One of the more junior officials, who's still alive, is said to have engaged in corrupt conduct, but no prosecution is recommended because they're not sure there would be sufficient evidence.
Because the evidence, so testimony gathered by the NAC, is not admissible in court.
Yep, yep. So the only person who's still alive...
there's two. I thought it's two.
No, the other one is dead.
No. So there is Mark Withnall.
Yes.
And Serena Wilson.
Oh, yes. Okay.
But, were both found to have engaged in corrupt conduct of a, quote, serious nature. Neither will be prosecuted.
And the primary criminal, the person at the heart of this scandal that did many, many wrong, bad things, but was overall a very honest, hardworking, driven person, but mainly just obsessively career-motivated, Ms. Golightly, not from the movie, is unfortunately dead. So and she cannot speak up in her defence, but by the NAC's findings is the primary culprit here.
Yes, because the people above her essentially push the blame down on her, and the people below her push the blame up to her, and she's now... inconveniently for her, dead, but very convenient for everybody else involved, rather dead.
And now, the primary reasons, well, so the secretary delegated all the difficult stuff, particularly with the legislative legal aspects, to the now deceased woman. So the secretary isn't responsible, apparently, because they trusted this woman who's unfortunately deceased. So they've been badly let down, frankly. And also the secretary was extremely busy. Did you know the DHS is a large, decentralized and complex organization, and you can't expect the head of it to be across all pesky detail like their largest single budget savings program affecting thousands of Australians and calculating unlawful debts?
And the legality of it.
You can't expect a secretary to be concerned about the legality or other aspects of the largest proposal they're taking to the government during a budget. You cannot expect that.
Yes. So the upshot is that the secretary, who was responsible at the time, essentially escapes any kind of ruling of corrupt conduct. Basically, as you say, she was super, super busy at the time and should have been able to rely on her subordinates, such as the aforementioned, unfortunately deceased, Ms. Golightly. So she's off the hook. So the head mandarin is off the hook. Now, the minister involved is also off the hook.
Well, look, and the beautiful thing about this, from my reading of the report, is the minister never really put anything in writing about any of these issues. It's all conversation. Nobody kept any cogent records of the conversations. The secretary who was working with this minister hasn't got any recollection of the minister ever saying, I want this to go through without needing legislative change or discussing the issues at all.
Because, as context, if this was a fundamentally illegal plan or under existing legislation, you would need to pass legislation to make it legal.
But if you're in a hurry and you just want to get on with the job and it's very important you get some budget savings and welfare recipients are the best place to get that, the best thing is a don't ask, don't tell policy where you just put it in place and get it all rolling.
Yes,
but the lovely thing, there's an accountability void here. Because the only people that can tell us whether they had these discussions or didn't have these discussions are the people directly involved who have no interest in saying that. And the paper trail doesn't lead there or back.
Yeah, so Mr. Morrison is off the hook and the...
Catherine Campbell is off the hook.
The investigation uses interesting justification for this and basically says, well, we can't find a smoking gun. And by the way, as a minister, Mr. Morrison would have known that if he had done anything fundamentally dodgy,
if he had
pushed through a new policy proposal that was fundamentally illegal, he would know that it would come back to bite him, that eventually he would be found out. I find this quite a remarkable justification. It sort of says nobody
would do something wrong,
including a cabinet minister, would ever do anything wrong, because they would know that somehow
they might be found out later.
They would be found out later. So, Mr. Eddie Obeid, for example, New South Wales minister,
currently serving jail time,
who's been locked up for a long time because of corruption involving coal land that could be developed for coal. And one of his colleagues
benefiting from public
in the
office.
New South Wales government at the time. He's been locked up for actual corruption. But apparently ministers don't engage in corrupt conduct because they know that eventually they would be found out.
Well, and let me, can I just read out a couple of little slabs about what the NAC report says about the then secretary? Surely even more unlikely in a case like this, where the supposed benefit to be derived from the crime could never have been more than an unprovoked hope that a then junior cabinet minister, which was Scott Morrison at the time, of another department would be so gratified by the Expenditure Review Committee's adoption of a proposal developed at his request as to determine and be able to secure the public servant's further advancement. So their only motive can have been an expectation of advancement. That seems an odd supposition. Pleasing ministers is a ticket to recognition and success for senior public servants. So that's the incentive in the system. Then it goes on, it seems to me it is yet more unlikely in a case like this where the supposed object of the deceit was to cause ERC to adopt an unlawful proposal.
Expenditure Review Committee, so Subcommittee of Cabinet.
Since ex hypothesis, it would have been obvious to the already very senior career public servant with a long and unblemished record of achievement and recognition, see that deference coming through there, that the unlawfulness of the proposal would in all likelihood soon be revealed. The offence would thus be detected, and what would follow would be the inevitable consequences of conviction, well, that's certainly not the case, and severe punishment, or at best, abject ignominy and career-ending discipline. So again, no senior public servant on this measure would ever do anything wrong for fear of discovery at a later point. And it's interesting, in the criminal justice system, this is not a defence. So your average bank robber or person accused of manslaughter or murder or grievous bodily harm, they don't get off the charge by saying, but you would know, Your Honour, that I would expect that I might be found out
If I'd done it.
So therefore, I wouldn't have robbed the bank because that would affect my reputation. It might result in a conviction. So I put it to Your Honour that there is no grounds to prosecute me. You don't often hear that used in a court of law, and it doesn't often end in an acquittal. But with the NAC, that is the new hypothesis of unblemished virtue that they suppose ministers and senior public servants to have, and therefore everybody is innocent.
It is very odd. I mean, another one of the oddnesses in there is that the deputy commissioner who did this investigation disagrees with the Royal Commission in many places. And it's to go, well, who are we meant to believe?
Well, the Royal Commission didn't come up with these crazy hypotheses of, well, they must be innocent because to be discovered would cause discomfort, therefore they would never, ever do anything wrong. The Royal Commission didn't seem to have that set of philosophical somersaults.
So we have the Royal Commission saying one thing about misdeeds, shall we say, on the part of some of the participants.
Well, I think the Royal Commission talked about corruption in public office.
Meanwhile, the NAC investigation has said, no. The Royal Commissioner, you got it wrong.
Got it wrong, yep.
So that's all a bit odd to me. Now, if I were Catherine Campbell, who was
The secretary at the time,
who moved on to the position of Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade when all of this
was
kind
breaking,
of, when all hell broke loose.
Yep.
She was essentially quietly moved aside from the position of Secretary of DFAT, probably one of the most prestigious positions in the entire Australian public service.
I think another Mandarin, one over in defence, created a special job for her to quietly move her.
Yes, so she was quietly parked inside defence as this sort of special
AUKUS advisor.
Getting a secretary's salary, but essentially fundamentally humiliated. And after that, left the public service. Well, if I were Catherine Campbell, I would be going, I now have a certificate, a 450-page certificate from the NAC saying I'd done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
But you destroyed my career, government.
Yes. Yes.
My career has been destroyed.
Take action. Get some damages for the horrible damage to her life and reputation now that the NAC has given a 440-page dissertation about how there's nothing to see. Yeah, I agree. That's the only logical thing. So the NAC's main purpose when you get a massive scandal in public administration based on illegality that causes suffering across a wide part of the population is to disagree with the Forensic Royal Commission and blame a dead person.
Mm.
So I'm not sure that we're getting the improvements to public administration that you'd hope from having a national anti-corruption commission.
Two people, Michael, have been found judged as having committed corruption. I would note that neither of these two people made any money out of their corruption other than continuing their jobs. But it's very clear from this investigation that both of these people were kind of living in fear of their jobs because they were working for somebody, you know, don't want to speak ill of the dead, seems to have been a bit of a workplace psychopath. And they were terrified of losing their job. So, you know, they're basically trying to satisfy their boss, who is apparently reading the tea leaves of what ministers and secretaries want.
Without any paper trail.
Yeah. So, but the only people found to have committed corrupt conduct are these sort of people lower down the chain. People, I would also note, who were not specialists either. So one of the things that the assistant commissioner says of the NAC who did this investigation is, well, Mr. Morrison wasn't a lawyer.
Yeah.
So you can't really expect him to raise legal concerns.
No, legal schmeagle stuff.
Legal schmeagle. Yep. Is this policy proposal illegal? Yeah. You can't expect the secretary to do that.
No.
But neither of these other officers were actually legal experts either. One of these gentlemen had spent 20 years as a school teacher and school principal, which is another kind of interesting parallel to some of our broader discussions about defence.
Expertise.
That there is a fundamental lack of technical expertise inside the Department of Defence, and seems to be sort of a similar case.
Well, it doesn't hold people back in their careers. And back to this incentive structure, you know, this, like, the NAC seems not to have spoken to anybody who's worked in the public service, even though it obviously,
well, other than the people they're
the affected parties, because there's an enormous dynamic in the senior executive service of pleasing the senior people above you and pleasing whoever the minister is.
I think this is referred to as upwards management.
Yes. And so enormous time and attention is devoted by the senior executive service and the military equivalents to discerning what your boss wants without them having to ask you, and discerning what the minister wants without them having to directly ask you. Because putting some of these instructions in writing can cause discomfort when people look at it afterwards. And in any case, to have to ask means you've failed. So the whole incentive structure for advancement and success is to please the hierarchy above you and please the minister of the time. That is the incentive structure that is so palpable in this NAC report about robo-debt, and yet it doesn't seem to have occurred to the NAC that this incentive structure exists. So they have completely failed to comprehend the system that operates in Canberra.
All right. Well, so another depressing report, and unfortunately one that the Fischer-Tropsch hopper refuses to turn into liquid fuel. Moving on.
I have some good news about capability. Like, one piece of good news that got brought to both of our attention was how fantastically successful in anti-submarine warfare a French warship is. And it's the Fremm. And people might remember the Fremm. It was one of the shortlisted competitors for the program that gave us the UK's Hunter, which is experiencing that unfortunate childhood obesity and doesn't yet exist. But the Fremm wasn't as capable, I think, as this amazing UK thing that we hopefully will see at some time in the future.
Well, apparently not, because we didn't pick it.
No, and its primary role was anti-submarine warfare. That was the thing that we wanted. How's the Fremm gone in recent competitions and awards, over the last 4 years?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's doing that well, but, you know, so apparently the US Navy has awarded a French Fremm frigate, the Aquitaine, the Hookem Award. Ooh. And the Hookem Award is awarded by the US Navy to best ship in finding and tracking submarines.
Right.
And apparently for the fifth time,
right,
they've awarded it to a French ship. So the Frem, which was not considered good enough for us, no, is apparently now the best anti-submarine ship operating with the US Navy.
According to the US Navy, for 5 years running. Well, I'm glad we rejected that. Yes. Mm. And is that the same? That had come from the French Navy, that's not one of our two AUKUS partners, that is able to send 8 well-equipped frigates and a large aircraft carrier to the Gulf should there be a way of reopening the oil supplies through the Straits. 8 frigates plus an aircraft carrier. Our AUKUS partner, who we're getting to build our Hunter frigate, the UK, has managed to send 1 fairly aged destroyer, the HMS Dragon, to Cyprus.
Sorry, are you referring to the somewhat glaring disparity between current French and UK naval capability?
I am.
Okay.
I am. And unfortunately, that seems to include anti-submarine warfare, which is so important to our Navy. So we're partnering not with the 5-time winner, but with the UK.
Well, one of the interesting things about this is that the future frigate competition to select our future frigate, it was meant to pick a design that was mature.
In service.
In service, in the water.
Yeah.
So we picked a vessel that was not mature. The design hadn't been completed, so which meant it was certainly not in the water and certainly not in service. Meanwhile, the Frem was all of these things and seems to be quite good at ASW. So yet another example, I would say, Michael, of the MAC.
Yeah, the military advisory complex. Getting it wrong.
Getting it wrong again. Yeah. And in fact, the Mandarins consistently say, well, we do what the government wants. You know, the ministers direct us and we give them what they want. The ministers in this case said, we want a ship in service as fast as possible.
Yeah, proven in service design. And the Mandarins comprehensively did not offer that.
So, yes, what did the Mandarins, civilian and military, go back with? They recommended the ship that was going to take the longest to actually get into service. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we spoke about discrepancy in naval capability. That reminds me of an issue we spoke about recently. We spoke about the Chinese Navy's apparent ramp up in the production of nuclear powered submarines, and we were sort of postulating what could be behind this. Well, Rear Admiral Mike Brooks, I think known as Burbling.
Is this Biffin Brooks?
No, this is Burbling.
Oh, I Burbling.
Think Mike Burbling Brooks. Of the Chief of U.S. Navy Intelligence gave testimony to the U.S. Congress that the Chinese Navy is, quote, executing a significant strategic shift from diesel electric to all nuclear construction, representing a fundamental departure from historical construction of its submarines. So essentially it's moving from a mixed fleet of conventional, i.e. diesel
and
electric
and
nuclear
to
submarines
nuclear.
To an all-nuclear fleet, much like the US has done.
One thing that would tell me is they think they're mastering nuclear submarines. So this idea that there's this massive technological lead with the Americans over the Chinese, and that's why AUKUS is so terrific, the Chinese don't seem to think that. They seem to think they're mastering nuclear submarines.
Yes, well, as we've seen with previous classes of Chinese ships, they're quite happy to build one or two of a design and test them and see what
Learn
works,
and
what doesn't work. And then they'll improve it and build one or two more. They don't go, we're going to build an entire class of an entirely new design. So they're very incremental process, as we've seen with their aircraft carriers. So they have 3 aircraft carriers, all quite different as they've developed and improved the design. Yep. That seems to be what they're doing with nuclear-powered submarines. But when Burbling Brooks was in front of Congress,
This should have been done in secret. If it was here in Australia, we wouldn't have this reporting, because it would have been done with the right chaps in the right room in secret.
Oh, I agree. I mean, massive security breach here, but
the Babylon Brooks has spilt the beans. So, what did he say?
Well, he said that the Chinese currently have 60 submarines, of which at least 14 are nuclear powered.
Mm-hmm.
But by 2035, China could have up to 80 submarines with about half nuclear powered. So they're going to go from around about 14 nuclear powered submarines to roughly 40. Do the math. So in 9 years, they're going to grow by about 26 nuclear powered submarines.
Now, the Americans are producing 1.2 submarines a year.
So the Chinese are going to do three.
Right. But we, Australia, will have its first two AUKUS submarines. So that's two more for the... Oh, no, it's not two more, is it? Because that's just transferring existing submarines from the Americans.
Yes, we're sort of shuffling submarines around within the combined AUKUS fleet. So, yes, by 2035, if according to the, quote, optimal pathway for AUKUS, we will have one maybe going on to nuclear-powered submarines, which will be Virginia's transferred from the U.S. Navy. The Chinese, over the next 9 years, are going to grow by about 26.
And the combined AUKUS fleet is not growing at that rate at all.
So, yes, that's probably not good.
That's a disturbing balance. Look, just one other little factoid I know you had. Center for New American Security has put out some charts about missile production. They had one about Tomahawk missile production. So these things have been used at very high volume in the current Iran war.
Yep.
With a ridiculous claim from the American government that the Iranians had somehow snaffled one and shot it into their own school. But I don't think that holds up. But anyway, they've used a whole lot of these Tomahawks, so hopefully the production run is hot and running really well. What's the production look like in Tomahawks in the last few years?
Well, what it looks like, according to the Center for New American Security, is that over the last 7 years, only once in those 7 years has America ordered more than 100 Tomahawk missiles in a year, and that was probably... I mean, it's kind of a column chart here, so I'd say maybe 110, 120.
Right.
But in three of those 7 years, it didn't order any.
Yeah. And so that's just a little example of the huge bottleneck in U.S. weapon production, which this current war has made so much worse, and which unfortunately, like the global energy crisis, has a direct effect on Australia, because our defense plan is to have our entire military equipped with US manufactured weapons, but the US aren't making enough even for a short war like the one they're in at the moment.
So now, the good news is problem. I guess we can't actually fit many Tomahawks on our ships, because only the air warfare destroyers can carry them, and their primary role is actually air defense, not strike.
Our ships, yes.
It's bad news, but we probably couldn't use more missiles anyway.
But I think PrSM, the precision strike missile, the US made 53 of those last year. And I don't know how many they've popped off towards things like Iranian naval vessels moored at wharves. But when you're making that tiny number and you use roughly that same number in the first week of a war, that is a strategic problem.
Yeah, so last week we looked at air defense missiles, and there's data suggesting that the US and its allies are burning through stocks at an exponentially greater rate than they're being produced.
They're burning through years of stocks in days.
It seems like it's a similar situation in offensive strike missiles, not just defensive missiles.
Look, one thing a Grumpy's listener asked, they said, hey, what are your thoughts about what Indonesian President Prabowo is thinking now about having joined the Donald Trump Board of Peace, which one of Donald Trump's achievements when he announced the Board of Peace, when he was at the first meeting, he said he's brought peace to the Middle East. So he said that, but the listener said, what do you think Indonesian President Prabowo is thinking now about Gaza? Because Indonesia had talked about committing about 7,000 peacekeepers to Gaza. And I think the answer is pretty obvious, isn't it? He's not expecting to get that call about sending those peacekeepers there anytime soon. Wondering why he's joined this Board of Peace.
I'm not an Indonesia expert, but when the president of Indonesia made that announcement, first of all, to stump up the $1 billion admission fee to get into the Board of Peace, and then make a quasi commitment to send 6,000 peacekeepers to Gaza, my initial thought is, what the hell is he thinking? How can this possibly be in Indonesia's interest? Now, various commentators have said, well, Indonesia is a country that wants to play a bigger role on the world stage. This is a way of sort of catapulting into that position.
Into prominence, yep.
I cannot see how this can work out well in any way, shape or form.
Well, I cannot think that he's thinking it's a good idea now, now that Donald Trump has not brought peace to the Middle East.
I don't know. I mean, if you didn't think Donald Trump was a certifiable lunatic before the Iran war, I mean, has anything really changed? I mean, roughly, you know, 36% of Americans still think Donald Trump is doing a good job. So, you know, it doesn't really matter what he does. Certain people are going to think he's doing a good job. Maybe Mr. Prabowo is the same. I don't know.
He could be. Anyway, it was a great question to get. And, you know, my view is President Prabowo is keeping very still and very quiet about the whole thing. Well, thanks, Marcus. I got to get back with this stuff and start the installation and the siphoning out of the petrol.
And I'll finish the snacks and horse d'oeuvres for the wake for the major projects report. I am truthfully very sad that this is gone. So I think it's a major loss for transparency in Australia. I think it's a major loss for the Australian taxpayer. And I do think it will come back to royally bite the government on the arse.
I agree. Thanks, Marcus.